Hello, everyone. This is Caleb Osborne with episode number 61 of the Magnify Him Together podcast. Last week in our Discipleship for Disciples series, we learned with Matthew that Jesus extends God's mercy and expects us to do the same. This week, we get to spend part 5 of our series looking at two disciples who were brothers, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, whom Jesus called the sons of thunder. Now, there's much more recorded in the Gospels about these sons of thunder than any of the other disciples we've considered so far in this series. And brethren have been able to give whole series of full-length classes on James and John. So for this podcast, we're just going to focus on one aspect revealed about them, and that is their ambition. Now, it's important to note that there's much more to James and John than their ambition, and it's not really fair to them to characterize them by this one trait that they display. But we've chosen to focus on this aspect because we have limited time, and because this aspect of ambition is something that was a problem that many of the disciples in the group of apostles struggled with, and it's a struggle that many of us deal with today as well. So hopefully it'll be relevant and helpful for you. You are probably aware that on several occasions, Jesus would find his disciples arguing with each other about who was going to be the greatest in the kingdom. Now, I imagine that this is one of the more embarrassing things the disciples would end up reading about themselves in the inspired gospel records, because as it's recorded, it seems transparent, self-absorbed, and petty. But this ongoing debate about who would be the greatest reveals a glimpse of a very human side of this group of apostles. As humans, we're always trying to figure out where we are in any given hierarchy, whether the hierarchy is along a dimension of popularity, of looks, intelligence, skill, or just general goodness. We're always comparing ourselves to others. We're looking down at those lower in the chain so we can feel better about ourselves, or we're looking above us to try to maneuver our way up the hierarchy. It's one of the more ugly things about us as humans, but it's very, very common and natural to us. Now, perhaps if you were one of the disciples, you wouldn't be the one who's saying, I want to be the greatest, in the sense of wanting to have the position of the leader or the one who always speaks for everyone, if that's not something that appeals to you. But you're still likely comparing yourself to others and fostering a feeling of superiority on some dimension. Perhaps you would like to be seen as the most perceptive or wise disciple. Maybe you'd want to be the most liked, the most popular. Perhaps you'd want to be the most influential. Maybe you'd like to think that you're the most responsible or mature. Maybe you want to be the one who knows the most about the Bible, or the one who's the best organizer. Whatever your ambition is, our self-image usually revolves around whatever traits that we value most. And keeping our ego intact depends on feeling that we are superior in those traits to those around us. And for a lot of us, that self-confidence needs to be validated by recognition from others. And this is probably why, on at least 3 occasions in the Gospels, the disciples got into heated arguments about which one of them was going to be the greatest. Now, what might these disputes have looked like? Well, as we've seen in this series so far, the disciples were a very diverse group, coming from many different backgrounds with varying characteristics. I suspect that there were a few front runners for the position of who would be the greatest, and the rest of the disciples would line up behind their favored contender, hoping that if he ended up at the top, they could move up a few pegs in the pecking order. Who could those contenders for the top spots have been? Well, I can think of a few ideas. One would be the disciple Judas. Judas Iscariot. You see, he was from Judea, the only one of the disciples that know of that was from Judea, which was a more prestigious area in Israel. He was also given the position of the treasurer. He had the bag, he controlled the money, which is, of course, an honored position. And we know that the others listened to him. He was able to influence their thoughts and their speech. Then we have, of course, the Apostle Peter. He was a good contender. He was the most extroverted and assertive disciple. He was a natural take charge kind of guy. He was often a spokesperson for everyone. And Peter was included with James and John on several occasions when Jesus gave them great privileges. being the only ones to see the raising of Jairus' daughter, the only ones to see the transfiguration. And on both occasions, they were not allowed to talk about what they had seen, which of course would probably have inspired many mumblings and mutterings about jealousy and about why James and John and Peter got this special treatment. Later on the night before his death, Jesus would invite the three of them, Peter, James, and John, to go with him in Gethsemane for the time when he most needed a friend to support him in his struggle. But James and John, as the sons of Zebedee, had won a couple of further advantages. Because in addition to being in that close inner circle, including Peter, with Jesus, they also had the advantage of a relationship with Jesus, a blood relationship. So their mother, Salome, appears to have been Mary's sister, Mary the mother of Jesus' sister or sister-in-law, which would make James and John the cousins of Jesus. And of course, we know in addition that John was known as the disciple whom Jesus loved and was able to enjoy a very close and intimate relationship with him. And so there were these top contenders for the position of who would be the greatest. And all throughout the group of disciples, there was this jockeying for position in the hierarchy of who could be greater than who. But as his ministry wore on, Jesus still did not directly indicate who his favored disciples were. In Matthew 19, verse 28, Jesus told his disciples that when his throne of glory was set up, they would each sit on one of 12 thrones, ruling over one of Israel's tribes. Now, this was an exciting promise for all of them, but it did nothing to indicate which of the 12 would be closest to Jesus, or who would have the most power and influence. And it was soon after this promise that James and John began to think about how they could secure positions of importance in this new administration that Jesus was going to set up when he became king of Israel, as they assumed was going to happen very soon. In Matthew 20, just a chapter later, verse 20, we find that James and John come to Jesus with a request. And this request is part of a very special strategy. They've brought their mother to do the talking. Remember that their mother, Salome, was Jesus' aunt, the sister of his beloved mother, Mary. So when they come to Jesus, they approach him, they bow before him. Salome is in the front, and Jesus asks her, "What wilt thou?" Or, what would you like? What are you going to ask of me? And so Salome answers with a request. She says, "Grant that these my two sons, James and John, may sit, the one on thy right hand and the other on the left, in thy kingdom." Now, this attempt to secure the most coveted positions in the kingdom seemed initially like it was a good idea, and doubtless the other disciples were kicking themselves for not thinking of such a strategy first. It was brilliant because it didn't involve James and John engaging in direct self-promotion, and it would surely be hard for Jesus to publicly turn down a faithful, dedicated, respected mother in Israel like Salome. But Jesus was not to be manipulated. Instead of answering Salome, he looked at her sons, and he gently challenges them. He says, "You don't really know what you're asking. Are you able to drink of the cup that I'm going to drink of, and to be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" Despite having no more than a hazy idea at best of what he meant, James and John answer eagerly, "We are able." Now, the cup that Jesus is referring to that he was going to drink of was, of course, the suffering that lay between him and the accomplishment of his purpose, his time in his trial and his crucifixion. But you'll remember that drinking that cup was such an utterly enormous and daunting task that even Jesus pleaded with his Father in Gethsemane to let it pass from him, if it was compatible with God's will. And it's ironic that when that moment would come just a few months later in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus asked, as we already mentioned, James and John and Peter to come with him to support and encourage him in his ordeal. He asked them to stay and to watch with him. And yet when Jesus was drinking his cup, James and John, as well as Peter, fell asleep. They couldn't even stay awake to support Jesus in drinking his cup, let alone drink the cup themselves. So the glib insistence that they were able to drink of it was perhaps premature. And it wasn't very long until at the arrest of Jesus, all the disciples, including James and John, forsook him and fled. But despite knowing that James and John would not be able to drink the cup with Jesus at his hour of suffering, at least initially, Jesus answered their naive confidence with encouragement and only a mild reproof. He said, "You shall indeed drink of my cup and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with, but to sit on my right hand and left hand is not mine to give, but it shall be given to them for whom it is prepared of my Father." Well, the other 10 disciples overheard this exchange, and they were moved with indignation against James and John, outraged that they would make what they saw as a brazen power play. And so the rivalry and competing ambitions resurfaced in the group and would have erupted into another heated debate about who was the greatest, but their whispering and muttering was put on hold when they heard Jesus call them to him. So they obediently gather around Jesus, and he uses this foolish incident as a teaching opportunity. He explains that their ambition for prominence was focused in completely the wrong way. He compared their attitude to the Gentile rulers who were only interested in exercising their power by dominating their inferiors. "But it shall not be so among you," he instructs. "But whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. And whosoever wants to be chief among you, let him be your servant." Now, this was a completely revolutionary view of what it meant to be a good leader or to be a great leader. Jesus says that if you want to be great or chief, then your path has to be one of service. You see, Jesus actually does want his disciples to aspire to greatness, provided you have a correct understanding of what it means to be great. Because true greatness lies in the humble service of others. And Jesus goes on to demonstrate that this is true using himself as the ultimate example. Jesus says that he didn't come to enjoy the perks of power. He didn't come so that people could minister to his needs and wants and comforts and pleasures. He came to minister, he says, and to give his life a ransom for many. You see, James and John aspired to sharing Jesus' glory in the kingdom. And that's a goal that we all share. But they didn't realize that Jesus' greatest glory lay in his willingness to sacrifice. Jesus, the greatest of them all, had come to serve others. And the ultimate act of ministration and service, the ultimate demonstration of his greatness, was when he gave his life to redeem them and to bring many sons to glory. Well, it was only a short time later that this lesson would become terribly and vividly imprinted on the hearts of James and John and their mother Salome. The Gospels record that at the crucifixion of Jesus, there was a small group of his most dedicated followers who approached the foot of the cross. Included in that group was the disciple whom Jesus loved, John, as well as his mother Salome, the sister of Mary. As these horror-stricken mother and son gazed on their master stretched out and lifted up on the cross, what they saw through their tears would have sent a chill down their spines. You see, above Jesus' head, there was a title placarding his accusation, the crime for which he was being executed. In the clear, bold letters of three different languages, the title above Jesus announced that this man was the King of the Jews. And on either side of him, one on his right hand and the other on his left, hung two writhing, cursing criminals. And as she saw this, Salome would have finally realized with a shudder the enormity of the request she had made of Jesus for her two sons. She had asked that when he became king, her two sons could sit on either side of him. And yet here was Jesus, proclaimed king as he hung from a cruel cross, flanked on either side by cursing, pain-racked criminals hung from their own crosses in the very positions she had asked for her sons to be given. And John saw the same thing, and he saw before his own eyes the true cost of drinking the cup that Jesus drank and being baptized with his baptism. But amid their consternation, hopefully Salome and her sons remembered the rest of what Jesus had told them and the true lesson that his crucifixion was meant to teach. So remember that Jesus had said, after they had requested to be on the right and left hand of Jesus when he came in his kingdom, Jesus had told them, "The Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many." So as Jesus was offering up his last ragged breaths on the cross before their eyes, he was committing the ultimate act of selfless service. He was giving his life so that he could redeem us all. Redemption cannot be achieved without sacrifice. Glory cannot be attained without suffering. The cross must come before the crown and before the throne. Zebedee's family had to learn that their purpose in life ought not to be to become great for the sake of greatness. Their guiding ambition could not be just to gain a position of power, prominence, or authority. Instead, they needed to center their lives around service and sacrifice. Instead of strategizing ways to elevate themselves above others, they needed to be looking for ways to spend and be spent for their brethren. The lesson learned by Salome and John at the foot of the cross is beautifully encapsulated in the words of hymn 222 of our hymn book, which describes the impact of considering the sacrifice of Christ. I'm just going to read two of the verses from that hymn. "There behold his agony suffered on a bitter tree. See his anguish, see his faith, love triumphant still in death. Then to life I turn again, learning all the worth of pain, learning all the might that lies in a full self-sacrifice." You see, true glory, true might is only found in full self-sacrifice, in abandonment of your self-interest and dedication to the love and service of others. Now, although the Sons of Thunder were slow at first to grasp the power of this lesson, in the end, they would finally learn that true leadership is not about sitting on a throne. It's about nailing yourself to a cross. As Jesus had told them that they would indeed drink of the cup, and they would indeed be baptized with his baptism, it turned out to be true for both James and John. In Acts 12, James became the first of the apostles to be martyred for the cause of the gospel. He suffered a violent and early death by beheading. But his brother John lived a much longer life. In fact, he became the last of the apostles to die. And while we don't know the circumstances of his death, the cup that John had to drink was just as bitter as James's, and he drank it just as faithfully. For at least 6 decades after the death of Christ, John persistently preached Christ in the face of countless waves of persecution, while also faithfully and patiently shepherding the ecclesia in the face of growing apostasy. His participation in the death of Jesus was an ongoing, daily sacrifice. And much later in his life, his writings in the epistle of 1 John reveal that the lesson Jesus had taught him back in Matthew 20 had stayed with him. In 1 John 3, verse 16, John the Apostle writes, "Hereby perceive we the love of God, because Jesus laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren." So it appears that John learned the lesson that Jesus was trying to teach him in Matthew 20 and on the cross. What about us? Can we perhaps try to learn the same lesson? This week, let's try to examine our own private ambitions. Ask ourselves, what do we really want to become? What accomplishments do we want to achieve? What position are we trying to attain? How do we want to be seen by those around us? Let's also take an honest look at how we view ourselves in relation to our brothers and sisters. Are we comparing ourselves by ourselves and by each other? Or are we comparing ourselves to Christ? Because the only one whom we should be comparing ourselves to is our Lord. Philippians chapter 2 gives us a section that tells us how we should be comparing ourselves to Jesus and what that should inspire us to do. This will be our last passage. Philippians 2, starting at verse 3 from the ESV. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. It's the mind of Christ that we should be seeking to have in ourselves. So, what do we learn about Jesus from our consideration of his relationship with James and John today? Jesus wants us to aspire to service. I encourage you to tune in again next week when we'll be considering the relationship between Jesus and Simon Peter.